Today's September 9th, 2017, and this is Mobile News Podcast number 221. I'm Todd Gossaward, my good friend John Westfall, and today's title, well, I'm kind of torn. Originally, I was going to title it No iPhone Talk, but I think I should also, maybe I'll put it somewhere in the title later, note that Jerry Pournelle passed away yesterday, September 8th. And for those of you, I don't know, John, if you know who Jerry Pournelle is.
The name rings a bell, but I know that I should know more about him if you are talking about him on this podcast.
Yeah, so people know him probably three different ways. I have two listed in our show notes. The first way people know him is probably through his science fiction novels, of which there were many successful ones, including several that were co-written with Larry Niven, who had, you know, lots and lots of novels that I enjoyed. I can't say I've read a lot of Pournelle's novels, but that is probably how most people, many people know him. The second way is he was very much involved in a lot of the actual space race back in the 1960s, serving as a consultant for various things. But the way most technologists remember him is from his days as the columnist of Byte Magazine, something he called Chaos Manor. And Chaos Manor was this amazing column that was the first thing I read every time I picked up my copy of Byte Magazine from the table, you know, as soon as it got there. And that was because, unlike all other, well, I shouldn't say all other, most other articles back then, tech articles, were pretty much either rehashes of press releases or just plain dry. You know, kind of like academic writing, John.
Yeah,
not to insult you, but you know what I mean. And Pournelle infused it with personality and opinions, and not just opinions, right? These are opinions based on real life testing. When he wrote about something, he was writing about it because he tried it out, and this is what he found, you know, kind of thing. Any rate, so I believe that Pournelle influenced directly or indirectly every single person today writing in any language in the subject of technology is probably influenced by him or someone who was influenced by him. So, any rate, and I should note that although I never met him or spoke to him personally, I did kind of have a brush with greatness when Byte was relaunched as a web-only publication a couple of years ago by Gina Smith. As part of UBM, the same folks who do InfoWorld and other things. I was actually one of the writers for Byte.com, and Jerry Pournelle joined us, I think, a couple weeks after we launched. So I was at least on the email, private email list for the writer's staff. So that was my brush with greatness. And I should note, it is probably fitting that he passed away September 8th, which is also Star Trek Day, which, you know, he was not directly involved in, but given his influence in both technology and in science fiction, it seems somehow appropriate. And to you, I know you're like a super duper Star Trek fan, and a belated happy Star Trek Day to you too, John.
I appreciate that. Yep, there are Star Trek. I actually just picked up for my, I don't have a huge collection of things, but I was at a flea market 2 weeks ago that the owner called me and said, hey, I have a bunch of vintage video games in. Do you want to come take a look at them? And I picked up the, if anyone remembers the game Star Trek Judgment Rights from the early 90s. It was basically, it was the second of Sierra Online's Star Trek games from that era. And he had one of the anniversary box editions of it that came out, I guess, in the late 90s or so, and cost a bunch of money then, so I picked that up, along with a full inbox copy of Space Quest IV. So I do have some very eclectic tastes in actual Star Trek and parodies of Star Trek.
Now, I have a question for you. It's not in our show notes, but since you brought it up, and don't make me cry, but as you know, I'm going to lose access to Civilization Revolution when iOS 11 comes out.
Yes, we have spoken about that, I think.
We have rehashed that, I know, until that poor horse is down on the ground and in quite a lot of pain, having been spoken so much about. But do you have any Star Trek games for the iPad that you would recommend?
You know, I haven't really found one that I like in actually quite a while. And I think there are a few now that are freemium type games that are, you know, trying to get you to buy things. So I don't have any good Star Trek game recommendations. I still think if you want to play a really cool series of Star Trek games, and I think you can find them online through retro gaming websites and stuff, Star Trek Judgment Rights and Star Trek 25th Anniversary, kind of the two games based on the same engine. They're the early 90s Sierra Online releases. They're a lot of fun. And then Star Trek A Final Unity came out in the mid-90s. It was pretty good. But everything since then has been a little bloated. It kind of ran really choppy when it came out. There was Star Trek Online for a while that I played that I wasn't too big of a fan of. So if you really just want to feel like you're in a Star Trek episode and you're exploring and trying to figure out how to solve the puzzle, those are the games that I would recommend.
Okay. I think after we finish this podcast, I shall go into the App Store and start looking at what Star Trek entertainment is available to me to kind of help buffer the emotional loss of Civilization Revolution in a few weeks, I guess, whenever iOS 11 comes out. This is also not in our show notes, but since we're talking about things Trek, and I am also a Trek fan, you know, there's a new Star Trek TV show coming out.
Yes,
but
there's also a new parody TV show.
which is getting panned, by the way. The parody, I mean.
Well, the parody I'm actually interested to see. I'm going to give it a shot. But go ahead and what would you like to say about the actual Star Trek series coming out?
So there's a new Star Trek series. I believe it is only going to be available on their, like, a pay station that I don't have access to called CBS Access, or maybe it's an online thing. I don't know what it is, but it's not available on CBS, the, you know, free channel, advertiser channel. Okay, so fine. And this is the thing that's interesting and has a tech view, tech aspect to it. So this new Star Trek TV show is going to be available on Netflix, except in the U.S. and Canada.
Of course.
Of course. So I'm a little bit miffed.
The thing that annoys me about the new series, everything that we've read about it, is that every series since Gene Roddenberry passed away has gotten farther and farther away from Gene Roddenberry's vision. Now,
this is true.
Roddenberry, I'm not a Star Trek fan that thinks that Roddenberry had all the right answers and it never was wrong, because certainly a lot of things that he was a little bit off on. But I do really like the idea that the future would be fundamentally optimistic and that humans would have their stuff together by the time they could go out and actually explore their planets. And this is, you know, every reboot has been grittier and grittier and darker and darker. And they've been talking about, well, you know, the crew members don't all get along on this one, and they're, you know, it's more realistic and more gritty. Personally, I don't know how realistic that is. Me and my coworkers tend to get along much more than I see in pseudo-realistic TV shows. So that's why I think a lot of hardcore Trek fans who count the original series or Next Generation as their favorite Trek series really sort of have issues with Discovery as a new sort of Star Trek. And that's why, honestly, the parody series that Seth MacFarlane is coming out with,
Family Guy.
From Family Guy, the Orville. He is also a Star Trek fan, and he's basically said that his goal was to make a funny, you know, satire of the space genre, but also do good storytelling.
A la Galaxy Quest, which I loved.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm going to give that a shot and see how the first few episodes are. But I'm not really into the dark, gritty Star Trek, because that was what every other sci-fi had going for it. It was the dystopian view of the world. I liked an optimistic view of the world. Maybe that's just me being naive, but if that's being naive, then I'm happy with it. So
don't push my bubble. And I'm in your camp, John. I mean, you know, there are plenty of dark sci-fi genres, novels, TV shows, movies, whatever you want. Well, you know, there's, you know, the postman and, you know, things like that. So That was the thing about Star Trek that really appealed to a lot of people. It was bright, literally bright, right? It was well lit.
Yep.
It wasn't dark like Alien. We knew things bursting out of people's chests. It had people who were funny and smart, but still slightly flawed and human. Mm-hmm. And people worked in pretty well as teams. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was a very appealing show, and that's why, although it wasn't appealing enough to last past three seasons in the original incarnation. True. Maybe it was too bright but it certainly lived on in terms of our culture.
Very true.
So, I'm hoping for the best, because the last Star Trek Enterprise, oh my gosh, what a disappointment.
Well, again, we started to see with Enterprise this let's be like other sci-fi genres.
Yeah.
And it just, Star Trek captured a lot of people's attention because it wasn't the same as every other genre. And so I think CBS's decision to try to make it more like what they think it should be marketable as is misguided.
Yeah.
Maybe it'll have, you know, and what their demographics are telling them, what their marketing people might be telling them, is that the old Star Trek fans like you and I are not going to be their primary audience anymore.
Yeah.
And so that could be it. We're simply not the ones that they're catering to. I can understand that. But
it's like when Microsoft used to tell us they weren't interested in our opinions of Windows Mobile, Windows Phone, because we didn't represent the masses.
Yeah, because, you know, I never need to look at a calendar, like the calendar view of a month anymore.
Right. They only had a two-week view.
I only look at this week because I never need to know what day the 28th of the month is on or something like that. But, oh, Microsoft.
Yeah. But anyway, we digress so much.
Digress and go into inside humor, but... buy us a drink or sponsor our show, and we'll tell you the story that goes behind that.
There you go. Okay, so moving on a bit from Star Trek, although I almost hate doing that. a couple of things. So Ookla, you know, the folks behind speedtest.net, which is, you may have your issues with how they measure, blah, 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 but probably the best known speed test around, I think.
And I have no issue with their name because it's always fun to say.
Ookla? I don't even know what it means.
I don't know if it has a meaning. But it's fun.
We should look it up. But anyway, they released a new 2017 Q1, Q2 mobile and landline speed test data results, and it's kind of interesting. You know, I mean, I don't think it's surprising, except unless you're a Verizon Wireless, an AT&T user who believes their commercials that say they're the fastest, because according to now again, you know, you can say, well, you know, it's methodology, blah blah. Okay, fine. Granted. But at least Ookla's data indicates that T-Mobile is, I would say, significantly faster than both Verizon Wireless and AT&T. Not tremendously, but I use significant in a statistical sense, where yes, there is a difference in speed. But it's, you know, it's, so AT&T is about 20 megabits down, Verizon Wireless average, about 21.1 megabits down. And T-Mobile was 23.17. That's nationwide. Sprint, you might be wondering, where is Sprint? Well, Sprint's way back down there at 15.39. Anybody who's used Sprint will say, yeah, that sounds about right. And, you know, for those of us on Google Fi who split our time between Sprint and T-Mobile, we know instantly when Google Fi switches us from T-Mobile to Sprint, because all of a sudden our web access goes way down. It's like, whoa. And this data seems to support it, right? It's about two-thirds the speed, roughly, of T-Mobile. So, yes, we are not imagining this.
For those of us, for those listeners that go, wait a minute, they're not the fastest, Verizon has just a network that exists everywhere. So yes,
they're the biggest. That is
something that they claim. And so if you're looking for something that will cover you in the middle of nowhere in the U.S., go with Verizon, you'll have fast enough speed. But if you're in a saturated area, T-Mobile usually has higher speeds. You know, I remember that from when I was a T-Mobile customer. Now, here's my question for you. Who owns Ookla? Do you know which company bought them?
Well,
2004.
I think indirectly they're owned by Verizon now. Because I think AOL or somebody bought Ookla, and Verizon bought AOL, so I think Verizon owns Ookla. Is that correct?
Do you happen to know? Ziff Davis.
Oh, Ziff Davis, which is owned by... Ookla. Did Ziff Davis get bought by anybody?
Yeah, they are a subsidiary of something, but I'm trying to look at what the... Okay. J2 Global.
Oh, okay, the old fax company.
Yep.
Okay, I know, I was confusing Engadget. Engadget is owned by AOL.
Yeah. Yeah, that is interesting. Since we're talking about publishing earlier on in the podcast.
Yeah, that's a whole different discussion we should have someday about who owns what and, you know, the claims of editorial independence, which, you know, could be true. I don't know.
We have complete editorial independence on this show.
Yes, we do.
Because we are self-supported.
Yes. So. That said, if you would like to buy our opinion, we are for sale.
Yeah, like you said many times before, we do not believe necessarily that our opinion should always just be our own. So
that's right.
If you would like to help us form an opinion.
That's right. We are not close-minded.
No, but we can be for the right price.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Now, okay. Now, speaking of moving on to something completely different, the U.S. Postal Service, not something we often talk about in terms of tech, but they have a kind of a, I think it's a new service that I just learned about it the other day, called USPS, United States Postal Service, Informed Delivery Service. And this is how it works. So you sign up for it on the website, and they figure out who you are, and mail that is going to be delivered to your inbox, to your mailbox, is scanned at the Postal Service, where else? And before it is delivered to you, they will summarize the images, or collect, I guess, the images of the outside of the envelope of what is going to be delivered to you that day. So, mm-hmm. You know, if you're waiting for, a check or an invoice or, you know, whatever it is you're waiting for, you will know before you go check your physical mailbox what is coming to you that day, which I thought was kind of interesting. Not sure how well it's going to work, but I signed up for it.
I could see that really useful for people whose mailbox is far away from their house.
Mm-hmm. Like people with
P.O. boxes. At the end of a road, or P.O. boxes, or mailboxes in an apartment complex that mm-hmm. might be a five-minute walk to go get. So you don't want to check them every day if you don't have to, but you do want to know something comes in.
And, of course, many of us, unlike you, John, do not live in walking distance of our office. So
that is true.
We're miles away when the mail gets delivered. So, you know, even if our mailbox is right next to our home, it's still pretty useful.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking forward to seeing how it works. I don't really have any important mail, but, you know, I can see all the junk mail I get. You know, like people who send me, the platinum or black credit cards, whatever one that's ridiculous. The black Visa card or whatever it's called.
I will point out that we are basically saying that mail is not all that useful to us, but if, say, stamps.com wanted to sponsor us, mail would become very useful.
There you go.
To
or
us.
USPS. And,
yeah, or USPS. Or, hey, if other companies would like us to say that the mail is completely useless, we're happy with that, too.
Yeah, FedEx, UPS, we'll say the other thing, too.
We will blow with the wind.
Yep, we're good.
As long as the wind has money with it.
Okay, now here's a topic I think I'd like your opinion on, because I'm not sure I'm reading this correctly. So reading 9to5 Mac and other places, looking at the release, or what will be the released version of iOS 11, they are saying the next iPhone models are going to be called 8, 8 Plus, and X.
Mm-hmm.
Not 7S, 7S Plus, and, you know, 7 Pro or S Pro or whatever. Which means for the first time since the 3G, now I got to think about this now, 3G, 3GS?
Yep.
There's no TikTok. It's tick,
yep.
Tick.
So 3GS came out in 2009. So back when iPhones used to come out in June.
Right.
So we are going to break a precedent if this happens.
Yeah. First time in, well, not quite a decade, but pretty darn close, 8 years, 7 years, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And also the other precedence it breaks is, generally speaking, the physical form factor of the phone only dramatically changes every 2 years. on, you know, so Tick, big change, Talk. Physically not much of a change, some innards a change, and then Tick again, and you get, you know, like 6 is dramatically different from 7, and 5 is dramatically different from 6. But apparently, well,
this wouldn't surprise me much, and that's purely because if you think Apple's product roadmap is usually set 2 or 3 years at the least ahead, and in many cases when Steve Jobs died, they said he had a 5-year roadmap out there. In the last 4 years, we've seen Samsung produce phones that are incredibly big leaps every year.
Yep.
You know, even if and now you can make the argument that between the S8 and the Note 8, it's not that big of a leap anymore. That's a whole different story, but I do think that Apple decided about 3-4 years ago that TikTok probably wasn't going to be the way that they wanted to go to stay competitive with Samsung.
That's a good point.
Not that I think that Apple worries too much about Samsung, but I think, you know, it's good practice to not be seen as dated, and Apple has gotten a lot of complaints in popular press and even among users of, okay, well, it takes forever to get that feature, you know,
right.
It has that feature. The thing that I'm still a little annoyed about and that I will miss, at least I think I'll miss, who knows, maybe once I get Face ID, I'll be just as happy with it as Touch ID, but I like not having to look at my device to unlock it. I like by the time I get the device to my face, it's already unlocked, so...
Well, you know, and I'll say this about that. The Nexus 4, when it first came out, had face recognition to unlock the phone.
Yep.
And I used it, and it was okay. And I will say it was nowhere near as good as fingerprint ID on the current generation iPhone. In terms of convenience, accuracy, you know, blah, 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 blah. Moreover, Face ID is fraught with danger, in my opinion. You know, it's one thing to force somebody to unlock their phone using their finger, right? I mean, you know, to physically grab somebody's hand and shove their thumb or finger down. And you got to guess which finger, right? They might not all use a thumb and index, right? They might use a pinky or something. I remember my daughter when she was, you know, I don't know, how old was she at the time? About 16, I guess, 17, something like that, when the 4 came out. She wanted to see something else. She wanted to see photos on my phone. And I said, not now. You know, we've got stuff to do. So she just grabs my phone, presses the button, puts the front-facing camera in front of my face, and unlocks my phone.
Yep. Well, and here's a scarier solution or scarier situation. How many times have you gone to the App Store and hit the buy button or something, and then it prompts for Touch ID?
Right.
And you go, well... Do I hit that by accident? Do I really want to do it? You know, it's that extra step.
Right.
I could see people going, I didn't mean to download that thing or whatever, if it just pops up, looks at you, and goes, oh, yep, you're here.
Yeah. I have my concerns about this. Same way I had concerns about losing the headphone jack in the 7, which I still miss, by the way. I still have not gotten used to that. I still don't like it.
But I'll reserve judgment for the most part until the 12th, until I get a chance to look at all this stuff. I am, depending on what they release for the Apple Watch, I'll go on record now saying that I'm at about maybe 40% interested in the new iPhone, and I don't think if I decide to get it, I will get it the day, you know, pre-orders. I think I'll wait until maybe around Christmas time. And I'm about 60-70% interested in a new Apple Watch, just because I'd like a little faster one than the original one that I have right now. And other things like a 4K Apple TV, well, I don't have a 4K TV, so I really don't care about that much.
Yeah, and I don't either. You know, I'm one of those people, I mostly watch video on my iPad, believe it or not, even though I have a television and I have cable TV service and I have a Roku and, you know, all that kind of stuff too. Watch streaming video and so forth on a big TV, but not interested. I like holding the iPad up. It's very handy.
As I'll be talking about in a few moments, I've already spent far enough money recently
that
I think waiting sounds really good. I might be fine just waiting until things are reliably in stock in mid-November or so to upgrade this year.
Right. So two comments from me on those topics that you just mentioned. Item one, Apple Watch. Originally, I had zero interest in whatever it was that was coming out. But as I mentioned last couple of podcasts, my trusty Moto 360 first gen, which I only got 2 years ago, August of 2015, is like powering down with 70% battery left. So I don't know what's going on with that thing. And, you know, basically I can't press it to reboot until I take it to its, you know, its wireless charger. So that's kind of a hassle, as, you know, and I can imagine traveling and my watch doesn't work and TSA goes, why do you have a non-functional watch on and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, hands up, buddy. You know? So I may be in the market for an Apple Watch to replace my Moto 360, which if it were still functioning, I would not be interested in buying a new watch. It's perfectly fine for what I need. I don't have a real fancy use case for a smartwatch, but I'm interested. Item number two is the new iPhones. I'm debating. I think I'm on the next plan where I can, you know, just continue paying my monthly and trade in my phone and get a new one. Don't know if I'm going to do that, but I am kind of curious what the iPhone X is. You know, basically I heard it goes to an OLED screen. Not really thrilled about that. Don't really care if, you know, the how deep the black colors are on the screen. I'm perfectly happy with what I got now. But if it has additional features, like, I don't know, Apple Pencil support or something, I might be interested.
Yeah, yeah. I think we talked about the Apple Pencil briefly.
Yep.
I'd be interested in it just because sometimes I'm holding my Apple Pencil to use with my iPad Pro, and then I pick up the iPhone, and it would be nice to not have to put the pencil down.
Right.
That's a really stupid use case, but I'd still like it nonetheless.
Okay, now things we are not expecting, but we would like to have. I would like to have a new Mac Mini.
Yeah, not, I would go for that too.
Not going to happen. We know that. I would like Apple to admit that that Touch Bar is stupid on the MacBook Pro.
Don't think that's going to happen either.
I don't think it's going to happen either. And expensive. If it were just stupid, it'd be okay, but it's stupid and expensive, which makes it bad. That taking away the earphone jack was a really bad idea.
Not going to happen.
And that they're going to release a new EarPod for under $100, which
definitely not going to happen.
Yeah. So all the things I want to happen aren't. So I'm kind of sad. Oh, also, I wish they would release a new MacBook Air. Because the current one, I think, is like 2 years old. The one I bought for my daughter. I mean, I don't mean I bought her a two-year-old computer, but the, you know, design is not being refreshed for 2 years, I think.
Yeah, well, the Mac Mini, I am very close to just saying, no, I'm not even going to bother with it anymore. And that's partially because of the story that I have to unfold regarding my battle with network-attached storage.
Okay, so with that wonderful segue, let us launch into John's Ranting Corner.
Okay, John's Ranting Corner. So let me tell you a story about a company called Mosey.
Mosey.
Okay. Mosey is a cloud backup company that came out. They released right around the time Carbonite first launched.
Okay, I know Carbonite.
Mosey is still around, but it was well known among early Carbonite users that the problem with Carbonite was that there were certain things that just didn't back up,
like raw files, right?
Yeah, raw files, EXE files, they're just, you know, if you wanted to back up your music and your videos and your, you know, pictures, those sorts of things, you were fine. But, yeah, if you wanted to back up other things, you're out of luck. Mm. Mosey did not have that limitation. So back, I suppose this was around 2010 or so, I signed up with Mosey and I uploaded all of my data to Mosey, and then Mosey decided to change their pricing rather dramatically. And the good deal I was getting became a very potentially horrible deal on the realm of probably, I think I calculated it, and I was paying somewhere like $100 a year at the most, and it would have been $400 a year to stay with them. So that went away. So I was a little bit shy at that point to go to cloud backup. Then about 2015, or maybe, no, earlier than that, 2013, CrashPlan launched in the home market, and they said, hey, all you can back up for $150 a year for 10 computers or $59.99 for one computer. Mm-hmm. I thought, well, that's a pretty good deal, so I went with that. And then a few months ago, they announced that they didn't want home users money anymore.
Yeah.
And I understand that because I have something like nearly 4 terabytes backed up with them. I can understand that that's probably taking up some space and they're not getting their money's worth out of me. So I am now twice bitten, very shy on cloud backup.
Mm-hmm.
About 2 years ago, I picked up a QNAP NAS unit, network attached storage unit, that was a cast off from a company that I do consulting work for. So it was just sitting kind of in my closet over here. I hadn't used it for anything, but last week or 2 weeks ago, I thought, you know, maybe that's my solution. Maybe I will just go to network attached storage. Right now, my home storage is a Mac Mini server that is not getting any newer, and external hard drives attached to it. Nothing is in RAID configuration or anything like that because I had CrashPlan. So I figured if things ever got really bad, CrashPlan I could download from. So I go on Amazon and I look for drives for my NAS unit. And I decide, okay, well, I have the NAS unit, so I'll just buy 4 terabyte drives. That should keep me very well stocked with storage for a very long time. And I already have the NAS unit, which is the expensive part. The drives are not, are, you know, $130 each, but they're not horribly expensive. So I buy them, and then I realize I haven't used actual hard drives and and desktop computers in years. So I don't have hard drive mounting screws.
Oh.
So I order hard drive mounting screws, and I use overnight shipping so that they show up on the same day as the drives.
Right.
Well, last Friday, I get my hard drives. And I get my screws, and I put my hard drives in the little caddies for my NAS. Now, I had turned on the network-attached storage before I ever even ordered anything to make sure it was working, and it booted up, and it said, you know, what, you know, put in a hard drive, and we can install the operating system, all of that. So I go to slide the first caddy in, and I realize that it needs low-profile screws. The screws I had... We're standard hard drive mounting screws. And of course, because I got this thing secondhand, the screws that were supposed to come with it didn't come with it. You know, they were, you know, used on the new drive, etc. So, but all right, now I'm not going to get this done this weekend. I will just order the right screws, which were way cheaper the second time around because I didn't care about next day shipping. So I order the right screws. They show up on Tuesday of this week. Go put the hard drives in, get them all mounted up, put them in. The network attached storage will not boot.
Ooh.
It will not even start up.
Oh.
Yeah. So.
Now, this is an older device. It's just been sitting around.
It had been working, though, the previous week.
Okay.
So it purely was just mocking me at this point.
Right.
So I took it apart, and I tried seeing if maybe there was a loose connection or maybe some other problem. It would, you'd press the power button, the fan would spin up for like a second, and then it would stop.
Okay, so you know the power supply was doing something.
Yeah. But I realized, you know what, there's just nothing I can do with this thing. It's I don't want to mess with it as much to get it fixed. I don't want to start swapping components and chips and whatever else. So now I've got...
16 terabytes of drives.
Yeah, $560 of drives. Well, I guess I need a network attached storage. So I went on Amazon and I found the updated version of the QNAP NAS that I wanted.
Okay.
It had good reviews. It had a good high price tag too. So now I have a very nice network attached storage that showed up yesterday.
Okay.
Have all the drives in it. It's working.
Okay, that sounds good.
And I am out like around $1,500 when it's all said and done with this whole crazy experiment. Wow. Which over the next few years will, you know, this is something I expect will last me for about 10 years, hopefully. But it's one of those things of Crash Plan, why did you have to kill my $150 a year and get me to this? Now, the saving graces yesterday, as I was getting my NAS drive set up and the RAID 5 configuration was formatting, I was sitting over here by my Mac Mini server, and I heard...
Oh, no.
A hard drive knock of death. Little bit like that. Not as regular. Not as... And only when accessing certain parts of the drive.
Oh.
On one of the external drives that had been my prime, one of my data drives from the old setup. So it is now syncing up with the the NAS. I'm trying to get the data off of it as quick as possible. But I guess it was fortuitous timing because it seems like I have a drive that's dying in my old setup. So, and I really don't feel like downloading 1.9 terabytes that was on that drive back from Crash Plan. So hopefully I'll get all the data off before the drive dies.
Okay. Now, so having been now moving aside from your NAS, so having been twice burned by cloud services, what is your feeling?
I think I'm gonna roll my own. So I've got this network attached storage here. I'm going to actually sort the files a little bit better of what is important and what is just I like to be able to keep around because I have the space.
Right.
And then at some point in the future, probably we'll talk with a friend of mine who has a lot of storage as well. And maybe we'll set up some sort of agreement where he syncs up some of his files to my free space. I sync up some of mine to his. That way we've got... an offsite, or I could just buy another one of these units and put it at work or something like that to sync to. So I am permanently out of the cloud.
Yeah, but that would be another $1,500, right?
That is true. That's why it probably won't happen anytime soon.
Yeah. And you know there are other things that affect us too. Like remember, and it hasn't happened yet, but I think about a year or a year and a half ago, you and I were discussing the fate of Evernote.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, they were changing their pricing models and they had switched CEOs and blah, 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 blah. And quite frankly, Evernote's still around. I still use it daily.
Yep, same here.
I still worry about it daily because, you know, for a while, and maybe this is good, for a while Evernote was expanding and you would hear Evernote's doing this, got Evernote notebooks and, you know, Moleskine partnerships. And then that all disappeared. They kind of... It went back to core competency, which I think is good. But on the other hand, we don't really see much coming out of Evernote anymore. You know, I mean, we see an occasional update, but...
That is true. And so that's why I've started... I use Evernote still daily. I still store a lot in Evernote. Yeah. But I do yearly full backups of my Evernote
to
HTML file.
Which is easy to do. They allow you to do that really easily.
And I've been investigating things like Collate, the open source note-taking platform that is getting closer to an official release. I've been using OneNote for some things that lend themselves better to notebook, you know, paper notebook analog style. But yeah, it's getting kind of scary with the Evernote world. But really the saving grace about spending all this money is that now this NAS pretty much does everything that my Mac Mini server is doing. So I think the Mac Mini is just going to retire, and I'm not going to bother getting a new one if they ever release another Mac Mini.
Okay, so for you, the Mac Mini's value is basically as a backup server, and that's it.
It was a backup server, a media server, an ebook server, a VPN server. I mean, it did. It had a lot of uses, but... Really, since the QNAP will also support virtualization and I can run a Linux virtual machine off of it.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
I should note that I also upgraded the RAM. It came with 4 gigabytes of RAM, two on, two sticks, and I bought an 8 gig stick for $50 that I installed in it. So now I have 10 gigs of RAM, and it's got a Intel i3 processor in it. So it's fairly quick and responsive. So I think I'll probably just... put a Linux virtual machine on there for anything that it doesn't run native. I can have a little VM that will I can log into and run software on and just do that. The only thing I am really missing is like an Apple provisioning server and a few other things that only run on Mac. But I have two old MacBooks over here that I could always spin up and use for those things if I want to. So.
Okay. Well, and of course, the other cloud service that, you know, I really should maybe get the license for Crimea River is my old Spot watch. You know, the watch itself was functioning fine. It's just that Microsoft turned off the Spot service, which I guess you could nominally call a cloud service. It was, you know, kind of before the word cloud became really popular to use. But when they turned off the Spot service, the watch became fairly close to useless.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's kind of sad.
Oh, and the other thing I should note about when you do jump in technology, this QNAP NAS service has a ton of mobile apps and even a dedicated Dyn DNS type system where you can get back to your own cloud. So I may end up stopping or not using as much services like Dropbox and OneNote, or not OneNote, but SkyDrive. Yeah, OneDrive.
Yeah,
I can remember SkyDrive. I can remember Windows Live Mesh. I can't remember the current name.
And you're so young.
I know. I can remember FolderShare before it got subsumed by all this. But yeah, it's one of those things where I didn't want to move off of this setup. I liked having an Apple server, but geez, Apple, you can't just update the Mac Mini once every presidential administration and think that I'm okay with that.
Has it been even that frequently? I mean, it's been a while.
We're at about, what, must be around 10,050 days now, somewhere around then, since the last Mac Mini refresh.
Okay, Johnny, while John is checking, I will
hoof it. You got to know for sure, because it might actually be 1,100 now.
Yeah. Mac Mini. Yeah, because I have got a 2008 iMac that needs to be replaced, and I don't want to buy another iMac. You know, I'm perfectly happy to replace it with a Mac Mini if I could find a current Rev. Well, let me rephrase that. A next generation Rev, whatever that might be, which doesn't exist, for, say, $500. That's really all I need.
We are at 1,059 days since the Mac Mini was last updated in October of 2014.
Wow. That's like a dystopian future movie, you know?
It really is. The last time, October 2014, before that, it had been July 2011, June 2010, October 2009, March 2009, August 2007.
Wow.
Apple used to love the Mac Mini. Doesn't love it anymore.
Well, yeah. Okay, so we will regroup, hopefully sometime next week, and we should have all kinds of information about whatever Apple talks about on September 12th.
I'll probably be proven wrong, and we'll be talking about how I got up ungodly early on Friday morning to pre-order things. But we'll see. I don't think that's going to happen, but I never say never.
Yeah, I haven't decided what to do yet. We'll find out. I think this year I'm not going to try to rush into anything. Okay, well, that is it. We didn't even get to the topic I threatened people we would talk about if we ran out of tech items, so that was good. Our Fives listener knew, last week John and I were reduced to talking about protesting dinosaurs and ICD-10 diagnostic codes for initial encounter with the Orca.
And the best advice I can tell anyone who is in the path of Hurricane Irma, if a dolphin hits your house, do not go outside. That's how the hurricane tricks you to go out, and then it gets you.
Well, and on that note, you know, something I will mention, let me see if I can find it now. So if you go to the National Weather Service Key West office webpage, don't know if it's still up and running. I mean, I assume it's not actually in Key West.
I was going to say, is the webpage even still there?
It is.
I mean, we know the island of St. Martin is pretty much gone, unfortunately. Yeah.
So weather.gov/key, K-E-Y. And if you go to the webpage, let me see if it's still there. Oh, they took the message down. Okay, so What was there on the official weather.gov/key website? Basically, it said, "This as real as it gets. Nowhere in the Keys is safe. You still have time to evacuate." And of course, now there is no time.
Yeah, I do remember. I did see that yesterday. So we really hope. As I'm looking at it right now, it's right over. The eye is about, looks like maybe 80 miles off the coast. So,
yep. Hopefully everybody is fine.
Yep, exactly.
And I think it's going to ride up Florida and maybe into Georgia. Hopefully it'll lose some strength by the time it does that. But got some friends in that area, so hopefully they will be okay.
Mm-hmm.
Alrighty, folks. That brings to a sad end with a, to match the sad start of MobileView Podcast number 221. We'll hope to see all of you next week. Hope all the folks in Florida and Georgia are okay. Talk to you later.